Today's program is proudly brought to you by Culture City, a for-purpose organization that provides a place of acceptance and support for all autism families. For more information, visit culturecity.org.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. So, I love it when a cookbook gives me much more to savor than tempting recipes or beautiful photography. It gives me a sense of a character and also an evolution of that person's food perspective. And that's what I'm getting a lot of in this book right here, which is written by our good friend at Heritage, Nicole Taylor. How are you? She's in Bed-Stuy right now, not in our station, but close, almost. How are you?
Hey, Kathy. Thanks for having me on your show. Yeah, I'm riding through the beautiful blocks, the colorful blocks of Bed-Stuy. All the yellow leaves are falling down. It's gorgeous out today.
It is
gorgeous. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, I'm glad we can make this happen. I know you have a busy week, busy few weeks with this book. The Up South Cookbook, I guess I didn't mention the title, Chasing Dixie in a Brooklyn Kitchen. It is very you, and I love that because you bring so much excitement to every conversation that you've been involved in, you know, from being a host here on Heritage to throwing various different events for food causes in Brooklyn. So we love your journey, and it's an honor to have you and talking about this book. So, yeah. Congrats.
Thank you. A lot of hard work, a lot of, energy and time into this book. And it's, you know, it's really a story and a cookbook, but it's really a culinary journey about me moving from Georgia to New York. And so many players in the Brooklyn food scene are sprinkled throughout this book.
Yeah.
I say it in the acknowledgments, you know, I'm very grateful to be able to really have started the journey or, you know, a part of the journey on Heritage Radio Network. So I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, your show Hot Grease, it's a lot of people remember that one and they're like, oh yeah, Hot Grease, I know that show. So definitely a part of the family here. So I love the introduction, and it's short, but it's really evocative, and it really gave me a sense in a very poetic way of where you're taking us with this book. And it was surprising to me in some ways because, I was expecting, a lot of introductions start out with some really, like, visceral food sensory details or something like that. So, like, I don't know, the sound of fatback popping in a cast iron pan or, like, the smell of nutmeg or something like that, right? Instead, you give me, like, these snippets of a culture that makes my imagination try to fill in the blanks of the food. And it makes me sort of nod my head like, oh yeah, I see where she's coming from. Like, so for example, you say, still lakes and slow moving trees. You want a fish? Not that river. Someone had an accident and the car fell in, drowning everyone inside. Where I'm from, there's a story to be told, and there's always sweet tea chilling and mulberries dancing in the wind. I was everyone's child. Aunts, uncles, mama, and cousins were one and the same. See and repeat, I don't remember ever being taught to cook anything. My eyes were useful tools. So it's like, yeah, you know, this is where you're coming from. This is how food is shared and enjoyed and seen every day all around. And, you know, I got to say, it was refreshing to read. I've read a lot of cookbooks in this time, so yours was definitely stood out with the intro.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, okay, so let's talk about the nitty-gritty, pun intended. Sorry. You start out with grits, and or you start out with the pantry, but you get quickly into grits. And tell me a little bit about how this is so quintessential to your particular brand of Southern food.
Yeah, you get grits. I mean, you grow up in the South, I mean, it's a food that you always have in the pantry. Mm-hmm. It's something that I keep everywhere. Wherever I go, I'm always trying to find grits or take grits where I'm going, you know, even here in New York. I mean, it's essential. I think it is the most important thing, if not the thing that every Southerner needs to always have in their pantry. Mm-hmm. So grits is a really big thing. I know someone asked me, why did I start with grits? I'm like, it's a foundational food.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to find in New York City, but, you know, I make it work and find it.
Yeah, and you also play around with grits a bit. It's not just your standard. You have this, like, kind of like Arancini Brothers-inspired grits patty, sort of like a risotto ball. And then you have like a baked grits dish. You got grits in a waffle.
Oh my God.
That sounds yes. great. So,
yeah, I mean, here's the thing in the book and particularly in the grits chapter, you know, half of the recipes are like classic Southern recipes. So you mm-hmm. have a classic grit, you have a classic cheese grit. Even though I use some Northeastern cheeses, but then you have the savory grit waffle. Mm-hmm. which are grits, and it's mixed with other things, and you put it on a waffle iron. So you still have the classic piece, but you definitely have elements of, you know, me being in the Northeast and exploring other foods and other techniques. So most folks who are just used to, you know, the grits with a little butter and salt and pepper, they're going to open up that chapter, open up the book, and I hope that they're intrigued and say, wait, I can do something else with my grits.
Yeah, I mean, there's absolutely no reason why we wouldn't eat grit. It's not like it's not a regional, like you know, climate, like regionally specific dish. You know, anywhere you can get ground corn, you can make grits any season, too. So it's like it's a blank canvas, it looks like.
Totally. And you can use polenta. I mean, you know, polenta is a different texture. But I definitely think, and I know that if you wanted to do some of the recipes and use polenta, I mean, you probably just needed to watch some of the proportions in terms of how much water and stuff you went in there. Because some people are not going to be able to find grits, and they're not going to be interested in ordering them online. So I would say, yeah, sure, use polenta.
Mm-hmm.
And grits and polenta are essentially the same thing. Different type of corn and different kind of texture in the way that they're ground. That's truly the difference between polenta and grits.
Yeah, it sounds, and not color, right? It's, or, I mean, typically we see like the whiter, I don't know, grits, I think, but it doesn't have to be that way.
You can get yellow yeah. grits too. Yellow grits mm-hmm. are a thing. Again, it's just a different type of corn and the way that they're ground. But yeah, I like yellow grits.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer them white, maybe just because that's what I grew up seeing, you know, and having all the time,
yeah.
white grits.
But I love, like, yeah. the kind of, like, cross influences that you've picked up throughout the way and how it's shown in the grits chapter. But, like, all throughout this book, you know, you have and you give us those, like, those people who have inspired you and, like, the exact places, like, where you get yuzu or, like, where you – you know, have incorporated ramps into a soup because it's, you know, all the rage here at the green markets. yeah.
It
so it's definitely like a personal brand of Southern cooking. And I like that you note that Southern cooking is so vast that there's, you know, regional differences are, yeah, tell me a little bit about like the whole swath of Southern cooking because you're not, this isn't a book about like certain regions and trying to pick apart what is traditional where. You say that it's really too much to say. It's too much to pick.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this book, two things is definitely throughout the book, you're going to see, people, places and things that are indicative of me and my life living in Atlanta, being born in Athens and growing up there and living in the Northeast. So you see, you know, my food friends, you see the mention of markets. And you see my South. I mean, I talk about in one of the chapters is that you're not going to see shrimp and grits in the book because I didn't grow up eating shrimp and grits.
Mm-hmm.
That's a dish that, you know, a lot of people who have an abundance of seafood, they have shrimp and grits all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Or there are just certain things
Louisiana,
in the South
maybe.
that are not applicable to living in Northeast Georgia, and that's basically where I was born. So, yeah, the South is not one thing. I mean, people always assume that I'm from the South, that I know everything about hot Nashville style chicken. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, well, I didn't grow up in Nashville. Mm-hmm. I never really had Nashville style chicken, really, to be honest with you, until I moved to New York City. So, you know, what I try to say is that there are so many Southern cuisines. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a general thing about the South, and I like to say that it's a culture, it's a way of living. Mm-hmm. There are some basic pantry items, I think, that say the South. Mm-hmm. But there's so many dishes from Charleston and to New Orleans to Atlanta to Savannah. The South is a million different things.
Mm-hmm. And you can make it your own, you know, as you've shown.
Totally.
Hopefully inspire people to take their comfort foods and, you know, incorporate it into their lives and environment. So how did you start, you know, playing around with food in this way? And, like, what got you excited? Was it, you know, you mentioned when you first moved to Brooklyn, you know, it was a big culture shock. You know, everything was so different. And did it make the differences in the food memories more pronounced to you?
Well, I think what happened is, you know, I moved away at 18 and moved to Atlanta. And at the same time, you know, being a girl from a small town, I mean, Athens is a small town.
Mm-hmm.
When I moved to Atlanta, I was like, oh, you know, I don't eat pork anymore. I don't eat beef. So I was semi-vegetarian, and I wanted to get away from the foods that I grew up eating.
Okay.
But it all kind of changed when I moved to New York City, because I started looking around me, and I started seeing all these folks, you know, eating the food or preparing the food in the way that I grew up. So
yeah.
All of these memories kind of came back to me. On top of, I had this experience in the kitchen, or experiences in the kitchen where I was making all kind of food. So I essentially just kind of mixed the two together, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I love tomatillas, so I'm like, hey, let me incorporate tomatillas in some of the traditional southern dishes.
And then-
or like with the savory sweet potato pie. I like sweet potato pie. It's not one of my favorite pies, but I'm like, hey, let me try out a savory sweet potato pie. So it was just me just being creative in the kitchen, and not just being creative because I had a cookbook, but creative because I'm into food. I like being in the kitchen. It's not a job for me.
Yeah.
And a lot of this stuff just kind of came about just me being in the kitchen and being fearless in the kitchen and also tasting other people's food. And being interested in other people's lives and cultures that aren't necessarily from the South,
yeah,
but they may be, you know, living in New York City.
I love that there's so many people I recognize throughout this book, you know, Chitra Agarwal and, like, Takedowns. I'm like, yeah, this is all great. It's true. It's all true, I just have to say, this book.
Thank you.
So also, you know, you kind of, like, dive in and have made a lot of you know, connections in the greater food systems, I guess, community, with the Brooklyn Food Coalition, for example. And, you know, you've spoken at conferences. Because a lot of people ask me this, how do you get involved in your, like,
wow.
Yeah. A lot of people are like, how do I just, where do I start? You know, how can I participate and help make changes in my community? How did you do that? Because you did it so well.
I get that question a lot, too, and I'm always kind of like, I mean, you know, to be honest, two things. I'll say this. You know, all of this was very organic, you know, mm-hmm. for me. I didn't set out. I mean, I came to New York City. I moved here because my husband got a job, and I knew I wanted to do food, but I wasn't sure what that meant. I mean, I talk about it in the book, but Twitter is really the way that I connected to so many folks.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been at heart an activist and been, you know, very concerned about communities and what it means to build community.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really just kind of jumped in, you know, into these tribes, what I like to say, of people who I felt like had a like mind.
Mm-hmm.
And the advice I would give to people is don't try to do this big grandioso thing. Find, you know, people that have like mind and connect with them on a
right.
small level, even if that means going to a potluck with them. And I think naturally you'll be connected to maybe an organization that you can volunteer for, and then it may turn into a job. because that's essentially what happened to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I got a job at Brooklyn Food Coalition after going to the first conference, 6 years ago and being blown away.
Yeah.
Met someone there. They knew that I was passionate about food, and I was one of their first employees. I mean, since then, you know, I've consulted for other organizations and all that stuff. And I would just say for anybody, just jump in slowly. Mm-hmm. Don't have this big grand plan, but find your tribe. And more so, the bigger thing is get in the kitchen and cook. I mean,
I like that.
Get in the kitchen, explore and cook,
yeah,
and invite people over. And people outside of your circle, not the same people. Try to, you know, to make a point of inviting diverse people to your place. It just opens you up to so many different things, to solving problems, to having solutions. It's a total must for anybody who is really interested in changing anything in communities around the country.
So don't go it alone. I think that's like
no,
a good,
definitely.
Yeah,
and go outside
some
of your circle.
Grand
you know,
scheme.
Go outside of your circle.
And I like that. You got to cook the food that you want to talk about too. Absolutely, Nicole.
Totally.
We're just going to cut to a quick little commercial break, and we'll be right back talking
whoa,
more.
Whoa. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Whoa, whoa. Leave your worries at the door. Just where are we going? Don't nobody ride it, no. Yeah,
hey, this is Michael Harlan Turkel from The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You know, every Tuesday at 3 p.m., I stop in the studio, walk to the far side, sit in my favorite blue chair. If you ever stop by Roberta's, look through the window, and you can see that chair itself. You know, and I've been sitting here for 5+ years, 250 episodes, have met some of the best people in the food world, such great culinary minds. And recently we just relaunched our website, added a whole bunch of shows, but we still need you, our listeners, our friends, our fans, even guests themselves, to help us out. We're 501c3, a nonprofit, and we're not really doing this for the money. We're doing this for the love, for the greater good of the food world as a whole. So get on heritageradionetwork.org, click that little pounding heart in the top right corner, and, you know, give what you can, or just keep on listening. We'd love to have you.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Culture City, a for-purpose organization that provides a place of acceptance and support for all autism families. This is Culture City's founder, Julian Maha.
Culture City was really born out of necessity. You know, it was born when my, currently 6-year-old boy was diagnosed with autism. His name is Abram and he's nonverbal. And even though my wife and I were both physicians at the time, it was really hard for us to find any resources at that point to help him. All the other organizations out there that we know of, they do phenomenal work, but their main focus is basically finding a cure for autism. Our main focus is basically trying to prepare the community to accept not only children with autism, but their families as well. You know, in addition to that, we also want to provide help to these families in the here and now. You know, so tangible things like, you know, iPads for nonverbal kids, you know, financial scholarships, therapy scholarships, you know, art camps, and also some lecture series that can teach parents about, you know, dietary issues, you know, how to financially plan and things like that.
For more information, visit culturecity.org.
All right, we're back chatting more with Nicole Taylor about her Up South cookbook. And you're on the line still, hopefully, from Bed-Stuy.
I am here, standing outside of my favorite bar here in Bed-Stuy.
All right. it is a beautiful day for a little happy hour soon, hopefully. So one of the things I really liked about this book, because I'm like a up north girl, so I really enjoyed reading all these anecdotes and folk wisdoms and sayings throughout it.
Ah!
stuff like,
yes,
yeah,
I love those.
Like a closed mouth don't get fed. Okay, that's true. I'm going to start saying that.
So do you think they're all Southern? Because somebody was like, I don't know if they're Southern, but just kind of like American sayings. I don't know. Some of them are Southern, and some of them I feel like are just kind of, everyone says them. What's your favorite?
I don't know. Okay, so I was going to bring up, my favorite isn't really a saying, but it's the folklore that says eating leafy greens after 8 p.m. Gives you crazy dreams or kills you.
Like, oh, yes, yes. Oh, my gosh. So the story behind that, that's in the Greens and Things chapter.
Yeah.
I think I open up the Greens and Things chapter. I was in New Orleans with Fanny Gearson. Mm-hmm. Fanny, if people don't know, she's the person behind Dough Donut and La New Yorkina. And we were in New Orleans, and we bunked together one night, and we had gone to Koshan and had all of your basically collard greens. And I was like, girl, we're going to be dreaming like hell tonight. And she was like, huh? And I was telling her, I was like, you know, when you eat greens late at night, they're either going to make you dream, and they also going to, like, kill you. And they say, you know, you're going to die. I grew up hearing that. But it's really, the dying part has to do with people, like, getting gas and sort of crazy thing, but yeah. So I grew up always hearing don't eat collard greens or cabbage or certain type of greens like after 8 o'clock. She thought that was so hilarious.
Well, it sounds like, yeah, there's a digestion issue. Like you need to give yourself
time
to
yeah.
Totally. I don't know about the crazy dreams part though. I don't know how that
translates. Yeah, supposedly it gives you crazy dreams too.
Oh, man. I got to test that. One thing I really like is that there's a lot of greens in your book and also in Southern cooking. And a lot of people think of, you know, these fried foods, heavy foods, whatever, cream gravy, I don't know. But, yeah, there's like a healthy dose of, and I don't mean like some chopped salad. I mean like cooked green leafy greens.
Oh, yeah, totally.
On the table.
I mean, I like to tell people all the time, I'm like, okay, yes, there's a fried chicken recipe in the book. Yes, there's mac and cheese, and yes, there's red velvet cakes. But I didn't grow up eating that every week, maybe once a month, you know? Mm-hmm. I grew up eating a lot of greens, you know? Or at least the greens were always at the table for me to eat. Let me say that. and I try to really show that in the book. I mean, it's pretty much my life. I love leafy greens. So you see traditional classic, like slow-cooked collard greens and turnip greens. But then you have, you know, one of my favorite salads in the book is the raw bok choy salad with peanuts and blue cheese.
Yeah.
I love that. And I went down home. I was in Athens on a book tour, and I demoed that. People love that.
Mm-hmm.
Just the other night, you know, some friends did a private dinner for me, and they did the dandelion greens with oranges, and we didn't do it with nuts. A few people had peanut allergies, but it was great. And I like to tell people, I'm like, really? You know, the greens and the peas chapter are the bulk of the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's not all, you know, red meat and you know, sweet.
Yep.
Really, the star of the Up South cookbook, Chasing Dixie in a Brooklyn Kitchen, I would say, definitely the green recipes and the peas, for sure.
The peas, let's talk about those, because I'm holding right now your beautifully packaged little thing of Crowder peas. Excuse me. what kind of, these are field peas. And,
No, so you have stuff the you gave Sea me. Island red peas.
Oh, the Sea Island, yes, I read about that. Okay.
Yeah, Sea Island red peas is a recipe in the chapter, and they're actually from Geechee Boy Mill.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mill in South Carolina. He does grits, but he also, one of the few farms, there are only a few folks that are kind of growing the Sea Island red peas, but they are peas that can be straight to West Africa. They actually were brought here by enslaved Africans and off, you know, Georgia and South Carolina coast. I like to describe them as, you know, it looks like a black pea without the black pea. They're red and they're smaller. They're really great.
And I love that they're, so these were sort of like untouched or unmodified throughout the years because they were
correct.
On this island, so they didn't
exactly.
really modify. Yeah, that's really cool. And there's so many things you can do with these peas. I mean, in the spring and in the summer months, I find all these fresh shelled peas in my bodega. And I'm like, it's just amazing. You can like shuck them, and you can, with the fresh ones, you don't have to wait too long. It's,
So and you can freeze them. You can, I tell people, make a big pot of them, you know, and I say it in the book, make a big pot of peas, freeze half of them, you know, make some brown rice, have them the next week for something else. I think peas, I always say that's my barometer if a person really knows how to cook. I mean, the meat cooking, if you can make a pot of peas, I feel like you can do anything. You can survive, you can make a way. I think that's like a foundational thing.
Yeah, it's not about the meat. However, you do have a very good and very specific recipe for fried chicken that looks amazing.
Yes.
The spice mixture and then the batter. So you're a batter person, not like a dredging person.
I'm happy about my fried chicken recipe. I mean, it's a fried chicken. I think I use, do I use pecan flour? I use buckwheat flour. I use some kind of other flour in there. I forget, but I use a small batch of like a specialty flour. But the biggest thing I think with my fried chicken is that, with anything that you're frying, people get scared to fry food. I'm not afraid to fry food. And it's about really taking your time when you're frying food. And to me, I think you have to season the meat and season the batter. And you can have great fried chicken. I use peanut oil. I love peanut oil. I know people have peanut allergies. But they're definitely, you know, you can use lard.
You got coconut milk.
I love
milk.
A good fried chicken.
You have some coconut milk
again?
In this. You have coconut milk in this
yes,
recipe.
Yes,
that's really
yes,
cool.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, I use coconut milk and buttermilk in it to kind of brine it in there for a while.
And I love the fish and seafood fry that you talk about your great uncle holding every year back in Georgia. Tell me about Ben Taylor's.
Yeah, my Uncle Ben. Yeah, he's in the front of the book. In the front of the book, kind of opened up the dedication page with basically it's pretty much my grandfather, my mother, my aunts, and my great aunts and uncles. Most of them, my great aunts and uncles, all of them pretty much have passed on. But my Uncle Ben was an avid fisherman. He had a boat. He was big into fishing. I never met my grandfather, but he also was a huge hunter, and he fished a lot. But there was always fish around, and he basically would save all of his fish of you know, that he had over fishing over the year, and he would do a big fish fry. It would be for family and friends. And I remember that so vividly. And they would have something called a turtle soup. I tried to do the turtle soup thing, but that didn't make the cookbook. But that's really a homage. That fish fry recipe that's in the book is really a homage to the fish fry that he had for so many years. You know, I'm sure, you know, he would be really proud to see that he made the cookbook. He was a great man and someone that I definitely wanted to pay my respects to in terms of, you know, keeping on a family tradition.
Well, it does look like an awesome recipe, and I love that there's, like, whole fish that are fried up here, and it's, like, it sounds great, because, I mean, if you're going to fry, too, it's, like, feed and share. Do it for a lot of people. Make it a festive, and who wouldn't, you know, come? Who wouldn't want to come to that?
And I use porgy, which is really an inexpensive fish that has become so popular in New York City. When I was growing up, that was like the bottom of the barrel, as my mom says, poor people fish. And now everywhere I go in New York City, they have whole porgies for like $20-something dollars. I'm shocked.
Really?
I'm always shocked to see that. Yeah, I mean,
it's
you go to, you know, restaurants, they'll have like a whole fried porgy or a whole, you know, Asian-style porgy or something like $21. But they're inexpensive. You can get them at Whole Foods. You can go to Chinatown and get them like $4.99, $3.99 a pound. A lot of bones, but still a great fish.
That's probably it. Yeah, I mean, they are a locally caught, plentiful, you know.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Well, I guess that's about all the time we have for today, Nicole. I'm sorry. There's so much to talk about. I love seeing the cast iron pan throughout, and you get a sense of like how to put things together, you know, in a really simple and organic way. Hopefully, you know, taking your cues and hopefully people reinvent it from there.
I hope the book really inspires people to get in the kitchen. I mean, that is the biggest thing. And also inspires people to really, you know, connect with their family and connect with their friends. And, mm-hmm. and more so this book, you know, for people who may not be in the South, who are living in the Northeast or living somewhere else, I think they'll read this book and it'll take them back. So I hope it does the job in terms of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It took me to another place while still being recognizable and really accessible. So I'm excited.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. I have a lot of events coming up. I get a lot of questions about cast iron. So if people are here in Brooklyn, I'm doing a cast iron class at Brooklyn Brainery in December.
Awesome.
And I have all my events on my website, foodcultures.com/events.
All right.
So, yeah, I would love to see people.
Awesome. And follow Nicole at Food Culturist on Twitter.
That's it.
Yeah. And let's be friends. All right. Thanks so much for your time. And cheers. Thanks, Liz, and everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Ooh, I like the way you do. Whoa. Took it so slow. And
thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.